I just wanted to go over a few chronological points that Rashi, there's some difficult, complicated Rashi in terms of chronology. If you travel through Israel, you will notice that there are two cities that claim to be the home of Abraham. There is Hebron, which is largely Arab today, except for Kiryat Arba, and some very, very determined people who live in Hebron proper. And then Be'er Sheva. Now, Be'er Sheva is much south of Hebron, and that's in the Negev, or at least the northern part of the Negev. So where did the Avos live? So in reality, it's not always so clear. On one hand, we know that Avram lived in Hebron. We know that Sarah died in Hebron. And yet we are told that after the Akedah, Avram and Yitzchak went to Be'er Sheva, which is very strange since Sarah died in Hebron right after the Akedah, when she saw them, etc. So I just want to give you Rashi sheets, and there are different Rishonim that reconcile this. And Rashi's cheshbon is that the first 25 years, Avraham came to Eretz Yisrael at the age of 25, right, that's when Hashem said Lech Lecha, and initially he wandered into a few places till he finally settled in Elonei Mamre. Elonei Mamre. Now, what is the translation of Elonei Mamre? Elonei, or an alon, is simply an oak tree. So Elonei Mamre means the oak trees of Mamre. Who was Mamre? Avraham had three Canaanite people with whom he made a covenant. And in fact, they circumcised as well. This is Oner, Eshkol, and Mamre. And Mamre was the most righteous of them. So consequently, we are told in the Chumash itself that Elonei Mamre was the same location as Kiryat Arba, the city of the four pairs, which is in turn the same as Hebron. Okay, why is it called city of the four pairs? That's really because of the future, because in Maras HaMachpelah, you have Adam and Chava, you have Avram and Sarah, you have Yitzchak and Rivka, you have Yaakov and Leah. So we know from Lech Lecha, therefore, that Avram's first permanent residence in Eretz Yisrael was in Elonei Mamre, which is Kiryat Arba, which is Hebron. How long did he live there? So Rashi gives us a calculation that he lived in Hebron for around 25 years. So from 75 to age 100. And he left shortly after Yitzchak was born. Why did he leave shortly after Yitzchak was born? Because you remember that Sodom had been destroyed. Remember, Sodom had been destroyed around a year before Yitzchak was born. And as
he lived in Elonei Mamre for 25 years, or Hebron?
It's the same thing. Elonei Mamre is Kiryas Arba, which is Hebron. Okay? And after the destruction of Sodom, and Hebron is fairly near Sodom, you know, even today it's that way, Avram wanted to move away from the evil area that it was, even though it was destroyed. And instead, he went to the land of the Plishtim. And that is around Be'er Sheva. And if you recall, that is when Sarah was taken for a second time by Abimelech, the king of the Plishtim. And when Abimelech's people all had these orifices that they couldn't open, etc., they were stopped up. And this is right before Yitzchak was born. So under those circumstances, they made Avram prayed. They were cured. And there were seven sheep that were exchanged as part of a covenant of peace between Avram and Avimelech. And that is called Be'er Sheva. So Be'er Sheva actually has a bit of a double meaning. It means the Be'er, the well of an oath, because they made an oath, and the well in which seven sheep were exchanged. So the word Sheva is both seven and oath. Yeah, I'm sorry, I misspoke a moment ago. And there was Avram left Hebron before Yitzchak was born, because indeed the story with the Plishtim was the precursor. After Avimelech got better, that is when Sarah gave birth to Yitzchak, based on the teaching that if you pray for somebody else and you have a need, Hashem is going to answer you first, right? Because Avram prayed for Avimelech that they should be able to have children, That is when Hashem blessed Sarah and Abraham that they would have a child. Very important lesson. You need a shidduch, pray for somebody else who needs a shidduch. You want a child in your marriage, pray for somebody else who needs a child. Hamispalel al chavera, when you pray for somebody else and you need something, Hashem will answer you. But this is not a game. This doesn't mean, well, really, I want it just for me, but I'm going to pray for somebody else so I'll get it. It only applies if you really want the other person to benefit. So again, Avram spends 25 years in Hebron, and that is when the angels came, and that is where Sodom was destroyed. That's near Hebron. After the destruction of Sodom, Avram went to the land of the Plishtim. That is when Sarah was taken by Avimelech, and after Avimelech was cured, shortly afterwards Sarah gave birth. Now, and that is in Be'er Sheva. So where Yitzchak was born, Yitzchak was probably actually born in Be'er Sheva. Okay, the three Malachim were in Kiryat Arba, which is Hebron, but by the time Yitzchak was born, it was in Be'er Sheva. And how many years did Avram remain in Be'er Sheva? So it says he remained in Be'er Sheva yamim rabim, a long time, many days. What is many days? So Rashi says many days means a little bit more than Hebron. If Hebron was 25 years, then Be'er Sheva must have been 26 years. Because if it was a lot more than Hebron, the Torah would have given you a number. If the Torah doesn't give you a number, it means just a little bit more than Hebron. So according to Rashi, Avram spent his first 25 years in Eretz Canaan, in Hebron, which is Kiryat Arba, which is Elonai Mamre. After the destruction of Sodom and the encounter with the three angels, he relocated to the Plishtim, the land of the Philistines, which is around Be'er Sheva. That is when Avimelech took Sora, and this is the second time she was taken, because the first time was Paro at the very beginning. And shortly after Avimelech was healed, because of Avram's prayer, that is when Sarah gave birth to Yitzchak. And they remained in Be'er Sheva, Rashi says, for 26 years. Now, Rashi makes the point, after those years, they returned to Hebron. It's kind of like going back to Chernobyl after, you know, an atomic bomb, meaning Sodom had been destroyed, they got out of there for 26 years. But then the tumah had been eradicated, so they went back to Hebron. And therefore, according to Rashi, Avraham and Yitzchak and Sarah were already in Hebron many years before the Akedah. Why is that so? As we mentioned last week, the Akedah occurred when Yitzchak Avinu was 37 years old. They left Be'er Sheva when Yitzchak was 26 years old. So they actually returned to Hebron more than 10 years before the Akedah. And that is where Sarah and Avraham, Sarah died after the Akedah, but Sarah remained there the rest of her life, as did Avraham and Yitzchak. So, according to Rashi's understanding, we start off with Avram in Elonai Mamre, which is Hebron Kiryat Arba. After the destruction, he moves to Be'er Sheva, stays there for 26 years, relocates to Hebron, which means by the time of the Akedah, Avram and Sarah were already in Hebron, and Yitzchak as well, for more than 10 years. So the big question then becomes, that Rashi has to explain, so why after the Akedah? So this explains why Sarah died in Hebron, because Sarah was in Hebron. It doesn't explain why after the Akedah, Avraham and Yitzchak went back to Be'er Sheva. According to Rashi, they were not living in Be'er Sheva. They were living in Hebron more than 10 years before the Akedah. So Rashi, that's the one question that Rashi does not address. But I see that the Mefarshim say that Avraham and Yitzchak went back to Be'er Sheva because in Be'er Sheva, Avraham did a very special thing when they had lived in Be'er Sheva. That is, it says he planted an eshel. Now, what is eshel? So, again, the translation of eshel is he planted a special tree. But Chazal say, Eshel is Rashi Tevos. Achila, eating. Shesia, drinking. And Lamed is Lavoya, it doesn't mean the funeral, it means accompanying people, escorting them when they need tour guides or just company or to be safe and the like. And apparently what Avram did was that although Avram was Machnis Orchim, wherever he was, and the whole story of the angels is in Hebron, not in Beersheba, but apparently there was a special inn, a special hotel, a special large-scale Hachnasas Orchim called the Eshel Avram that was in Beersheba. And it's a little strange, we don't really have a clear picture. If Avram wasn't going to be living in Beersheba, why did he make his biggest thing there? Perhaps because Beersheba is right next to a desert, and that's where wayfarers needed the most hospitality. But it is said that Avram Avinu wanted to thank Hashem with a larger scale chesed than he was capable of doing in Hebron. Apparently his eshel was staffed. He had peace staff were managing it. He came down to the hotel, so to speak. Of course, it was a hotel for free, to give Shavach Vahoda'ah to the Ribbono Shel Olam, and then he went back to Hebron. But you see that this is a bit of a dochek, because our problem basically is, if they already lived in Hebron, why are they going back to Beersheba? If they lived in Beersheba, why did Sarah die in Hebron? Because you're going to have a problem. Avram and Yitzchak go to one place, Sarah dies in another place. Now, other Rishonim there, mamish the opposite. They say, Avram and Yitzchak were living in Beersheba already, and Sarah died in Hebron because she went to look for them, thinking they went to Hebron to give thanks to God. And she died, not where she lived, she died where she was looking for them. But that is not Rashi Shita. Rashi Shita is that Hebron is where they lived at this point, and Beersheba was simply where Avram and Yitzchak went to give Shevach V'Hodah to Hashem at the Eshel Avraham. I believe, I haven't been in Beersheba that many times, but I believe that in Beersheba they actually have some ancient tree or something that they identify as Avram's tree. And who knows? Nobody knows if that's possible. Trees can live. There are trees that can live thousands of years. There are olive trees that are very, very, very ancient. But we really don't know, especially if Chazal say the Eshel is lav dafka a tree. It's more like a hotel. Achila, Shesia, and Lavoya. Okay, so that's one thing to keep in mind, that it's not so pashut to know where Avram and Yitzchak lived at various times, but this is Rashi's basic shita. So remember, Eilonei Mamre, Hebron, Kiryas Arba are the same place. Okay, then Beersheba was a settlement that was named because of the oath that Avimelech made with Avram, as well as the exchange of seven sheep that was a sign of their covenant. So Sheva is both Shavua and Shiva, the number seven. Now another little point I wanted to talk about is that after Sarah dies, and Avram takes another wife, and after he marries Yitzchak, of course, right? Then it's marries off Yitzchak. And Rashi makes the very beautiful point from Chazal that it says that Yitzchak brought her into the tent of Sarah, his mother. She became his wife, and he loved her. And Rav Hirsch points out a very important idea, that the true love that exists between husband and wife is something that comes from the relationship. First they became husband and wife. And then when he saw the Kedusha that she brought to the bayis, then he loved her. People think that you have to have these stars and you have to have all sorts of romantic love beforehand. And of course, what did the Chazon Ish once say? The Chazon Ish once said, what the world calls love, we call kores. That's what the Chazon Ish once said. But anyway. Okay. But the point basically is that the deep love comes from living your life together. And at best, when you get married, you simply have an educated guess that this is the partner of my life. But you really know by living life together. And therefore, real love comes from the marriage. It does not precede the marriage. And in particular, Rashi says, why did he feel such a strong love when he brought her into the tent of Sarah, his mother? Because it says there were three miracles that were connected to the tent, to the home of Sarah Imenu. One was that when she would light a candle in honor of Shabbos, which the Avos apparently did, the light would burn the entire week. The other, there was a blessing in even the bread that she made. You ate a little bit of her bread and you were filled for the whole week. And the third, there was a tangible cloud of glory over the home, signifying that this was the makam of the Shekhinah. When Sarah Imenu died, all three of those signs departed. Avram alone, as unbelievably great as Avram was, he could not create that Kedusha without Sarah. But little Rivka, who according to Chazal and according to Rashi's view, was only 3 years old, when she came into the house, it couldn't have been the very minute, but at least after a week, because some of these are only things you see after a week, but be it as it may, the candle remained burning, the bread had a bracha in it, and the cloud of glory was over. Yitzchak loved her, not because she was beautiful, although she was. Yitzchak loved her because she was righteous, because she was holy, because she brought the godliness into the home that had been lacking when Sarah died. And that is something that's worthy of love. You love the goodness of a person. You know, the Vilna Gaon says, and a very, very interesting thought, the Vilna Gaon says that all love, if it's more than infatuation or sexual desire, all love of human beings is really love of God, because what you truly love in a person is you love those attributes that represent the godliness within their soul. So, and this could be even things that you think are not necessarily so. For example, if you love somebody's kindness, because their kindness is a reflection of the kindness of Hashem. You love their wisdom. You love the way they think. That is because of the intellect. That is ultimately a reflection of God. You love their sense of humor. And also, God has a sense of humor too, in different ways, as perhaps you have discovered over the years, and the like. So the Vilna Gaon says, there is no such thing as true love of a person that is not ultimately love of the godly qualities within a person. And this is what Yitzchak loved Rivka. Yitzchak saw the godliness by these things coming back and the like. And you know, it's interesting, the Ramban says a fascinating point. The Ramban says that the three miracles of the tent of Sarah are the same miracles that later existed in the Mishkan and the Beis HaMikdash after that. The light that lasted from Friday to Friday, in the menorah that was lit every day in the Beis HaMikdash, although it had to be refilled and lit every day, but there was one candle that never went out. We talked about the Ner Tamid. That candle never went out. Now, the truth of the matter is, there were times when the Jewish people were not righteous, it did go out. So it was not true that it always remained that way, but when the Jewish people were righteous, it did remain that way. And then the Lechem Apanim, the showbread, remained warm and fresh. It was put on the gold table on Shabbos, and they didn't eat it till next Shabbos. It was still warm. And the cloud of glory was, of course, over the Mishkan. So the Ramban says the important lesson is that the temple of Judaism, the Beis HaMikdash, is a Jewish home, meaning the Mishkan is nothing more than an imitation of the holiness of the Tent of Sarah. And the Tent of Sarah is a prototype for a Jewish home. So I'm sure you've heard the cliche over the years, it's been said in countless rabbinic sermons, that the most important institution in Judaism is not the shul, and it's not even the yeshiva. The most important institution in Judaism is the home, the relationship of husband and wife. Because in some ways, the Beis HaMikdash is just an imitation of the home of Avraham and Sarah. And we strive to create the home of Avraham and Sarah. So this is the idea of that love. But it's a very interesting thing. Avraham gets remarried after Yitzchak marries. Well, what's going on? Because again, it's hard for us to psychoanalyze here. But think about this. You know, Avraham loses Sarah. That's a tragedy. And Avraham, of course, is heartbroken. But he's pretty old. He doesn't have to get married again. But he sees all this Kedusha leave. And how does it come back again? When Yitzchak brings Rivka into the tent. So, Avraham thinks, if indeed marrying the right person brings holiness back into the tent, back into the home, then I ought to get married too, to bring that holiness. So, in many ways, just looking at the psukim, it appears that the inspiration for Avraham to get remarried was seeing the holiness that Rivka brought into the tent of Sarah. And therefore, Avraham was jealous, but jealous, God forbid, not in a negative way. But Avraham said, I too can recreate this Kedusha. In Ruchnius, it's okay to be jealous in a positive way. This is the famous statement in the Gemara, Kinas Sofrim. The jealousy of Torah scholars increases wisdom. That doesn't mean I'm jealous that I want somebody to fail. Oh, I wish he wouldn't learn so well, you know, so he could be, you know, just like me, whatever it is. You know, that's not constructive. But to look at somebody and say, you know, if he's doing something good, I can try to do something good. That's legitimate. And I would say, Lanias Daiti, that Avraham is looking at his son and saying the same thing. Look what he accomplished. Because Avraham was the one who got him his wife through Eliezer. Look at what he accomplished. I can do it too. I'm so old. I'm 137 because Avraham is 10 years older than Sarah. The answer is, you're never too old to do mitzvahs, whatever the mitzvah is. You know, I remember reading the Rav Moshe Feinstein. I know all of you heard of Rav Moshe Feinstein, although he's been a nifter already for around 25 years or more, and more than that already. But he was a great, great gadol, and very, very humble person. In fact, maybe I'll tell you in a second. I had one mice with Rav Moshe Feinstein, and myself when I was 9 years old. I'll tell you. But anyway, but I just want to finish this story first. So the last few years of his life, though, he was very, very frail, very, very frail. That's why, by the way, I'm digressing today, but that's why I think Rebbe Yoshev gets a bad rap, because you'll often hear the following. You'll hear the following idea. They'll say, you know, Rebbe Yoshev was towards the end of his life, you know, he only saw people like an hour a day, you know, he refused to see people more than that, but Rebbe Moshe Feinstein was seeing people, the door was always open, you know, he always saw hundreds and hundreds of people, but in a way, it's an apples and oranges comparison. I mean, the reason is, Rav Moshe Feinstein was nifter at around 91. So Rav Yosher was nifter at 104. And the MS is, when Rav Moshe already was 90, he was not seeing people the last year or two. So you can't really compare. Now, although it may sound to you, being a young person, hey, what's the difference, 25-year-old, 30? No, not a big difference. Believe me, although I don't know myself yet, it's a show, that 95 and 104 is a very big difference. It's not the same as 20 and 30. Yeah. So as a result, Rebbe Yoshua was actually doing superhuman. I mean, the fact that he was able not only to learn all day, but to see all the people that he did see, even if it was a small window of time, was really superhuman. You cannot compare it to Gedolim, who saw more people, but they were younger. They were literally 10 years or 15 years younger than Rebbe Yoshua. So people sometimes say it's a very, very unfair accusation if you really understood the situation. Okay. But be it as it may, with Rav Moshe Feinstein, the very last Shabbos of his life, now he didn't know this was the last Shabbos of his life, they were making minyanim in his house, but they couldn't get a minyan because there was a big ufruf, and like everybody went to the ufruf. So they told Rav Moshe, you know, maybe we have to daven Musaf B'Yechidus. Now his sons told him, we don't have a minyan. So Rav Moshe said, could you try to get a minyan? So I don't know who they found, but they, you know, they went around the whole Lower East Side and they managed to get people who didn't daven Musaf yet. I don't know. And Rav Moshe had tefillah b'tzibur. So when he was eating his last Shabbos Suda with his children, who themselves are great Rosh Yeshivas, Rav David and Rav Reuven, he took their hands and said, Remember, remember, you have to grab mitzvahs whenever you can. Never say you're too old. Never say you're too sick. Look for an opportunity to do a mitzvah. I'm sorry, did you want to say something? Yeah.
In regards to Abraham, he was looking at Yitzchak, and
yeah.
He saw that Rivka was bringing back the Shekhinah.
Yeah.
So what more did he want to add?
But the answer is Yitzchak was making his own home. In other words, Yitzchak is a married man, right? So Avraham wants to have his bias too. In other words, you don't just live through your children. That's also an important lesson. Sometimes, you know, we tend to live through our children. Oh, my child's a wonderful person. He learns, he does Torah, you know, etc. Avraham says, no, I still have to be a tzaddik also. I have to grow also. I can't just say, my kids are taking over. So I think that's a good mitzvah for a parent too. You don't simply say, oh, my child learns, etc. The Chatzim Rebbe used to say, everybody does everything for their child. He wants to meet that last child in history that everyone's doing everything for. Like, you know, I work so my child will learn. Then my child grows up, he'll do it for his child. So who's that last child that everybody is doing everything for? Okay. I remember years ago, I was once attending a Vada Chinuch, Board of Education meeting for a religious school. And the parents were discussing what extra learning they could add to the school day so the kids would learn more. You know, Mishmar, different things. These are like elementary school. So, you know, the kids had a pretty long school day already. You know, they're from modern Orthodox home, so it's not like, you know, Haredi, they learn 12 hours a day, you know, whatever. And I knew, maybe I shouldn't know, but I knew what a lot of the parents were doing at night, and it was not necessarily learning. But they're trying to think about all the ways they could inspire their kids to learn. So I thought to myself, you know, you want to inspire your kids to learn. You don't tell them, learn more. You learn more. When you learn more, that inspires them. Do as I say, not as I do, is not a good recipe for chinuch. The greatest chinuch is when children see what the parents are passionate about. Same thing with Avram. Avram doesn't simply say, oh, Yitzchak, you be a tzaddik. Avram still works with it. So, therefore, Avram takes another wife. And the wife is Keturah. But now, Rashi tells us, you don't know this from the Chumash itself. Rashi tells us, actually, Keturah is hardly a stranger. Keturah is none other than the wife that he kicked out a few years before. At Sarah's own instigation, because she was a bad, not she, but Yishmael was a bad influence. And Yishmael is now grown up and doing his own thing. He takes Keturah back, and she is now a righteous woman. Na'eh Keturah. Na'eh Ma'aseha Kiktores. Her deeds are as pleasant as the beautiful fragrance of incense. In fact, Rashi learns, even Yishmael did tshuva. Imagine, Avram leaves the world with everything, all the loose ends, tied up neatly. He comes back, Hagar gets reunited, Yishmael does tshuva, although that didn't last, but at least at this point in Avram's life. Even Esav, now Esav, remember, Esav was actually already born when Avram died. Esav did not become a public Russia till the day Avram died, as long as Avram was alive. Even Esav was righteous. So Avram really had this great completion of seeing all these good things. And from Keturah, Avram had children. 1, 2, 3, Zimran, Yokshan, Medan, 3, Midian. Right? Some of these are nations we know of. The Midianites, right, later. Yashbak, Shuach, etc. So we have really a number of nations that are called B'nai Keturah. So it's very interesting. The Gemara in Sanhedrin says the following statement. Although the mitzvah of Mila was given to Avram Avinu, and the children of Yishmael, this is a very common misconception, Yishmael circumcised. Yishmael had a bris when he was 13. But Yishmael's children do not have to have a bris. That was a one-time Yishmael thing. Although the B'nai Yishmael are not chayiv in the circumcision, Muslims do it, but they are not chayiv in circumcision, B'nai Keturah are chayiv in circumcision. The descendants of Keturah do have to circumcise. Now, there's a big machlok, this is a Gemara in Sanhedrin. There's a big machlokes Rashi and the Rambam, what that means. What does it mean, B'nai Keturah are chayav in Bris Mila? According to the Rambam, it just means these specific children. Now, according to Rashi, it just means these specific children. So, according to Rashi, it's exactly symmetrical to Yishmael, because essentially what it means is, Yishmael was born from Avram. He has to have a bris. These kids were born to Avram from Keturah. They have to have a bris. But it doesn't go forward to the new generation. The only way it goes forward is via Yitzchak and then via Yaakov. So according to Rashi's understanding of the Gemara, B'nai Keturah, in other words, basically all of Hagar's children are the same. Yishmael is Hagar's son when she was called Hagar, and these are her children when she's called Keturah. It's all the same. First generation gets a bris, after that, no obligation. This is Rashi, and in a way, it's very logical, because it's very difficult to see why would I treat the descendants of Keturah more than the descendants of Yishmael. According to Rashi, they're treated the same. The Rambam, however, has a very different interpretation. According to the Rambam, the B'nai Keturah were commanded to engage in Bris Mila in perpetuity, meaning to say, although Yishmael, it's only Yishmael and not B'nai Yishmael, but the descendants of Keturah have to have a bris. And then the Rambam gives you another halacha, and he says, since over time the descendants of Yishmael intermarried with the descendants of Keturah, and therefore when you meet an Arab, or an Arab himself doesn't know, is he descended from Keturah or from Yishmael, all Arabs are obligated in circumcision, but not because people think because they're descended from Yishmael. If they knew they were descended from Yishmael, they would not be chayav in circumcision. But rather, there's a cheshash, they might be descended from Keturah. So bottom line is that the Arabs, according to halacha, I don't mean Islam, the Arabs, according to halacha, are obligated to circumcise, according to the Rambam's view, but not because of their descent from Yishmael, but because of their descent from Keturah, in which there's an intermarriage between Keturah, between B'nai Keturah, because all of them were Bedouins. All of these nations were wandering nations, and obviously they intermarried, etc. Yeah. Yes, well, it is a good kasha, but there is a concept that a bris is a covenant, of course, a covenant. But a covenant can exist on several levels, and basically the descendants of Avraham all have a covenantal relationship with God. The Jewish people have a deeper covenant with Hashem. Now, the question you could ask is, well, wait a second, if you're going to simply say all descendants of Avraham have a covenant, so why do you differentiate between Yishmael and Keturah, especially since Keturah is Hagar? In other words, what I just said isn't totally true, because with Yishmael, we don't have a covenant that continues. So you have to say like this, you have to say that all of the children of Avraham that are born after the covenant that Hashem made with them, after Avraham's bris, all of them are within the covenant. Yishmael was born beforehand, so his descendants are not encompassed. But I would say this, again, it's an amazing thing, it's a difficult thing to understand, but that does mean Hashem has a certain, according to the Rambam, not according to Rashi, according to the Rambam, Hashem has a certain level of a covenantal relationship with B'nai Keturah. And in fact, the Sfarim HaKadoshim tell us this is why, in the period before Mashiach, The most dangerous adversary we ever face are the Arabs. Because every other adversary has material power, political power, wealth, weapons. Yishmael has that too. But all the other nations don't have spiritual power. The Arabs have what you might call dark, negative spiritual energy, just like there's matter and antimatter. And there's a certain koach they get, which is a destructive koach. It's not a positive kedusha. But it's like the nuclear energies, right? Nuclear energy can be used for power plants, it can be used for atom bombs. They have a spiritual power. And according to the Rambam, that spiritual power comes from Bris Mila. There is some level of covenant that they have with God. And that is why they are exceptionally dangerous. They are dangerous because if it's just Ruchnius against Gashmius, Ruchnius will ultimately triumph. But when it's Ruchnius against the spiritual force, that's going to be much more difficult. Yeah?
Is it true that
Yeah. So this is this. Now, that's a very good joke. Yeah, I was going to bring that up because, so according to the Rambam, the B'nai Keturah that were sent away, they simply hung around the desert and they interbreeded with B'nai Yishmael, and that's why the B'nai Keturah needs circumcision. But there is another tradition in the Medrash, which is not like the Rambam says, that when it says the B'nai Keturah were sent east, that doesn't just mean east into the desert, but east means real east. And that is, they found their way to China, India, Thailand, all those places. And it is said that the source of the wisdom of the East, which later got intermeshed with Avodah Zarah, like Buddhism and the like, but there is a core of spiritual truth in those religions, are the gifts that Avraham, says he gave them gifts and he sent them away. The gifts that he gave them were that which became the wisdom of the East. And that could very well be why, it's unfortunately so, but it is undoubtedly the case, that Jews are disproportionately attracted to Buddhism. Jews love Buddhism. If you're not from, you'll be a Buddhist. Because basically that's true. 90% of English-speaking converts to Buddhism are Jews. 90%, 9 out of 10. How could that be? On one hand, it's a very, very sad thing. Buddhism is probably idolatrous and the like. But on the other hand, there's something very good about it in the following way. Buddhism, and I'm not going to give a whole share on Buddhism, it's not okay. But Buddhism is a religion that is very non-materialistic. It focuses on simplicity, it focuses on spirituality, it focuses on equanimity, meaning accepting what happens in life without complaint, without bitterness. And since every Jewish soul seeks a connection to God, if they don't know that Yiddishkeit is giving it to them, they don't know what Judaism is. So they'll look for anything. In other words, what I'm saying is that a Jew who becomes a Buddhist is a spiritual seeker. It's not a religion of materialism. He's seeking spirituality. But Nebuch, the perversion is that they grew up with a Judaism that is materialistic, that focuses on money. So they think, I want to be spiritual. I don't want to be Jewish. What does Judaism have to do with spirituality? Right? Don't remember the high holiday tickets. If you don't, you don't have your ticket, you can't go. You can't go into the service. I don't know if you ever encountered that. I think today, in recent years, I mean, almost every synagogue has become more modern. But I remember as a kid, if you went to the bathroom, you had to show your ticket to get back into the show. Where's your ticket? Yeah, these big ushers. Where's your ticket? You know, there was blue for a kid and yellow for an adult. It's a different thing. You have to show your ticket to get in, right? So people grow up and they see this, you know, that people only care about money. So what I'm saying is, the very thing that is so sad that Jews are turning to Buddhism is actually a reason to be very hopeful that the Jewish neshama is looking for ruchnius, looking for a connection with God, And if they could see that Judaism has that, then Baruch Hashem, they can become the best Jews, the most devoted Jews, the Jews that are passionate and the Jews that are so connected to Ruchnius. Because that's what they're looking for. You know, you have to respect somebody who is a seeker, even if they're going in the wrong direction. Because at least they're looking. Sometimes you can have a person who is like born from and has been from all of his life, but he's not looking. Stagnant, not moving. Somebody who moves is alive, even if they're moving in bad ways, but you show them the right way, they'll grab onto it. So you're 100% correct that the reference here to sending him to the East might be a reference to the truths that are found in Eastern religions that then got intermeshed with paganism and Avodah Zarah. But there's a core of emes to them. So we Jews claim everything. We claim the Western religions. Christianity and Islam, you know, came from us. That's for sure. And now we even claim the Eastern religion. They're ours too. Avram is responsible for everything. All ideas about God and the world come from Avram Avinu, even though over the years it gets perverted and mixed up with all sorts of other doctrines as well. Okay, so this is the B'nai Keturah. Yeah.
Sorry, what was the
masa
with the
ropes? Oh, yes, thank you. No. I do want to tell you this because to this very day, it happened, I don't want to say how many years ago, but it happened when I was 9 years old, long time ago. The thing is that I grew up in Hartford, Connecticut. Some of you might know Connecticut. I know Matthew is West Hartford, but I'm from the old neighborhood, Hartford, Connecticut. Rav Moshe Feinstein used to take a 2-week vacation every year, and he wanted to go to a place where nobody would ask him any shilas. So I guess he identified all over the world where would be a place that nobody would bother him. He figured Hartford, Connecticut. Now, the reason he went to Hartford also because he had a relative in Hartford that he trusted, the kashrus and everything else. So I was in fourth grade, and I was zocha. I would like daven in a shul and then walk to school, you know, before school. So I was zocher to be in the car that would take him to shul every morning. And a lot of the things that I remember, you know, I read later in biographies, how I was transfixed because I didn't know Yiddish at all. He spoke in Yiddish. But I was transfixed. I clearly remember like a shining light coming off his face. I mean, I remember you know, looking, staring at his face a lot. And I also remember, it was fascinating to me, that between aliyahs, when there were aliyahs, between aliyahs, he had this mishnayos that he would learn, and I had never seen anyone. Wow, he learns between the aliyahs, the Torah reading, and the like, and even when he was wrapping up his tefillin, you know, and like I literally never had seen this before. So anyway, so one day, you know, we pick him up, go to shul, etc., daven, and it was raining that day. And everybody went home. I was still davening or something, and around 10 minutes later, there's a knock at the door, and the driver comes in and says, Rabbi Feinstein said he remembered you were in the car with us, and now he sees it's raining, so he asked me to take you to school. He didn't want you to walk in the rain. Now, the truth of the matter is, nobody else cared about that in particular. I didn't care. It was no big deal. The school was 2 blocks away. But here you have the Gadol Hador, you know, maybe the greatest rabbi of the generation, who didn't want a 9-year-old kid to walk home, to walk to school, to walk 2 blocks in the rain. And he asked the driver to come back. So to me, this is like a permanent, it really is very much, I was going to send this to art school when they put out for Moshe's biography, but maybe I'll get a story in or something, but I could write. But it wasn't, I didn't submit it on time or something. But anyway, but the thing is, to me, this is a real memory, because we could talk about Rav Moshe's, you know, he knew Shas by heart, he knew Shulchan Aruch, he could paskin any shaila, the most difficult shailas in the world. And that same person, who never wasted a second, who was a brilliant genius, who was the posek hador, but there was no one that was too unimportant for him to care about. And that's really the measure. To a great person, there is nothing that is small. We sometimes think, oh, I do important things. I'm not going to bother with unimportant things. To a gadol, there is nothing that is unimportant. There is no person that is unimportant. And to this day, you know, when I think of what is a gadol, that is what I think about all the time, because that is the definition of what a gadol is. So I think it's a great story. It's a big, big, big chizuk for me. Okay. Alrighty, so you all have a good day.